And it's another week. This is Andrew Wood, Executive Director of Hope Resource Center. Thank you so much for tuning in. You can learn more about Hope at investinghope.com. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Of course, you'll be able to hear our podcast up this week as well. You can go to iTunes, Podbeam, other places to find that. Our website at investinghope.com. Today's a special day because today, as we do often, we bring in guests. And today I'm joined by the president of Students for Life of America, Kristen Hawkins. Thank you so much for joining me today, Kristen.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we've met once in Washington for the March for Life, and you were busy and a lot of things going on. And so excited about connecting with you today as we talk about the work that's being done by what some would call, and I think we would agree, the pro-life generation. And so before we get into all of that, if you would, kind of just take us through what got you involved in the life movement, how'd you become an advocate, and how'd you get connected with Students for Life?
Sure. Well, I got connected in the pro-life movement when I was 15. I was asked to volunteer at a pregnancy center from a woman who sat across from me at church. And that's really where I kind of learned what was going on, the atrocity of abortion, how many women were out there hurting, how many families were out there suffering because of this so-called choice. And that's how I got started in the pro-life movement. I started a pro-life group in my high school, and when I went to college, I did the same thing. And when I got to D.C. after graduation, a friend of mine called me and said, you know, we think we want to do something with other young people, with going to college campuses and going on the offensive and reaching them, talking to them about this issue. And that's when we launched Students for Life full-time about 11 years ago.
Yeah, and it's amazing to watch. A lot of times millennials are, in some instances, rightfully so, kind of maligned and talked about for a number of reasons. But as we look at, if we want to reach a point where abortion is unthinkable in this country, and ultimately in around the globe, we have to, really, we depend on this generation that's coming up. I mean, it is the generation that we believe will make the change, correct?
That's exactly right. And, you know, and the polls show us that this generation is heading in the right direction. This is actually the first youth generation since the handing down of Roe and Doe in 1973, the Supreme Court decisions, which, you know, legalized abortion all 9 months, you know, for any reason. This is the first generation that actually polls pro-life, that many times when pollsters are asking Americans' opinions about the issue, a lot of times millennials are, you know, the most pro-life segment that are asked. This is huge. They've seen the reality of abortion. All of us have had friends who had an abortion, family members who had an abortion. We've all seen an ultrasound. We've seen our brothers and sisters in the womb. So, the dated talking points of the other side of it's a blob of tissue, you know, abortion will make everything better, we just know that's not the case.
Yeah, and that argument, and even for some on the side of abortion, they're at least, some of them are starting to get to a point where they're going, yeah, it's a life, but that doesn't change my opinion. And I still disagree with them, but at least we're reaching some point of honesty there.
Sure.
Because if you're making the argument that it's not a life, I mean, it's just at this point, you know, you want to talk about science deniers. At this point, you are certainly denying science if you say that that's not a life. And my wife's pregnant currently, and she's 12 weeks.
Okay.
And we just, thank you, and we just saw an ultrasound yesterday, and
aww,
it was clear. I mean, and you know, it's been clear with all of our kids, but yesterday, 12 weeks, heartbeat, you know, saw everything, and there's no question. But we could have walked out of there in what I would argue is the greatest country on the planet, and we could have an abortion for any reason. And so it's alarming to think that is where we are currently as a society. So let's talk about what Students for Life have been doing since 2006. Where have you grown, and how many states are you in? How many schools are you? How many campuses are you on?
Sure. Yeah. Well, we today serve over 1,100 groups in high schools and colleges across the country. We have active student life groups in every state in the nation, all 50 states now. Even we have a group in North Pole, Alaska, and,
wow,
and some groups in Hawaii, which I've been asking them to invite me to come speak.
Right.
So we, you know, we're all over. We've got full-time regional coordinators who are spread out across the country, who are right there with these students. They're there on campuses every day, mentoring them, helping them host events, helping them deal with administrative backlash that they may face, or something that's happened on their campus, or serving a woman who's come to the group pregnant and needing help. So we're very much involved right there on the ground level, right where the abortion industry targets. I mean, that's what's so important about this generation. We know that, you know, culture is made with young people, and that's why we have to make sure this generation is pro-life, because these young people are the ones that shape culture, who are going to be shaping our politics in the next few years. And so we've got to make sure these people, especially in high schools and colleges, know the truth about abortion. And we also have to be there because we're really those front lines of defense against the abortion industry. Because for many years, Planned Parenthood, their allies, they kind of ran unfettered on college campuses and high schools. And even still in some schools that happens today where, you know, the college has a relationship with Planned Parenthood, so the van from Planned Parenthood comes every week to pick up the girls to go have the abortion, or the health center knows to automatically refer all pregnancy questions to Planned Parenthood. And we really have to be there to intercept that relationship.
Right, and that's what we've run into. I mean, we're in a college town here in Knoxville, and you know, we're within walking distance to the university here, Land Grant Institution, you know, the University of Tennessee. And so one thing that people come up to me and they'll say, well, what kind of partnerships do you have on campus? And we have great partnerships with the health department. We have great partnerships with the nursing department. We have nurses that come over and intern and do different things at our facility. But what we also know is there are some areas where if a student finds themselves at the health facility on campus and they're pregnant, they're not necessarily referred to us. And it's there's a number of reasons why they're not. And so working on that, and so speak to what your college groups are able to do when you say to intercept that.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of your college groups doing to let the other students know, look, there are other options out there than a Planned Parenthood or an abortion clinic?
Sure. We encourage our groups to do something called a Pregnant on Campus Initiative, and that's trying to find ways to create tangible support services right there on campus, leaving signs of hope. So when she takes that pregnancy test in our dorm room, before she goes to Google and types in the word abortion, she'll remember that there's been somebody said something on campus about how she could continue her pregnancy, continue the life of her child. And so that, you know, it takes a different form depending on the campus. One of the biggest things we encourage our student groups to do is to work with their administrations to get diaper-changing stations in the bathroom, to get lactation rooms on campus, which are actually federally mandated in these public schools, to make sure that the resources that the campus already provides are actually advertised to the student body. So she knows that there are options for her, that she knows she doesn't have to choose between the life of her child and the life she's always dreamed of. A lot of times our groups will offer free babysitting services, or they'll host baby showers for women who've chosen life on campus. The whole point of this is to surround her with love on her campus. We've seen so many women, you know, change their mind and choose life, and it really wasn't a money amount that was offered. It was all it was really was knowing that there was someone there on her campus that loved her and that would support her. That's what the difference was.
Well, you know, and recently here at the university, we saw, and the story went viral, and I saw it all, I mean, USA Today, everybody picked it up, and it was a local student who is a single mom, and she emailed her professor here at the University of Tennessee and said, I'm going to have to miss class. Some babysitting stuff came up, and I obviously can't leave my child. And the professor emailed her back and said, I'm sorry to hear that. If you ever run into this again, bring your child with you and I will hold your baby so that you can take notes and focus. The last thing we want to do is create a barrier.
And so
you read about that, and we're reaching out to that professor to say this is the culture of life, because regardless of where you stand on for abortion, against abortion, or whatever. What we have is, we in that situation, is we have a mom that chose life. So what are we doing to assist that mom? And that's what I love about pregnancy center work. And you know, you talked about baby showers. We do 50 to 60 baby showers a year. So I would love to connect with the folks here on campus to see how we could partner with that. But ultimately, as you are going around and talking to the groups and doing the things that you do, what are you seeing? Are you seeing some strong pushback? Are you seeing a lot of campuses that are embracing y'all's group? What's it look like across the board? I know it may be different depending on where you're at, but...
Sure, it definitely depends. You know, we have the most legal challenges. We just filed a lawsuit today in Pennsylvania in high schools, in public high schools and private high schools, where ministers really just have never thought about what the First Amendment really means. And so, sadly, some of these principals or vice principals believe that they can shut down a Students for Life group and say that a pro-life group shouldn't exist because it's simply too controversial on the campus. Because of the lawsuits in recent years on college campuses, the word is sort of spread around not to mess with the pro-life groups on campuses. However, they face other issues. The college students face, you know, discrimination from professors. We've had students who've had, you know, really heated discussions with professors calling them out in class, then, you know, receiving poor grades on papers. Mostly the issue in colleges we find is that there's just a natural ministry of bias against being pro-life. So things will happen, like your paperwork to hold an event with a speaker will suddenly get lost, and no one knows where it's at. And you'll resubmit your paperwork, and that gets lost too. And then the deadline comes, and you miss your deadline for hosting the speaker because the paperwork didn't go through. The student groups face challenges of, you know, the pro-abortion groups coming to their events and protesting their events on campuses. Anytime they talk about Planned Parenthood, Planned Parenthood sends out their employees to the campuses sometimes to protest our Students for Life groups. I mean, these are paid staff from Planned Parenthood, so afraid of the truth that they are protesting volunteer student organizations.
Yeah, and you know, we're really at an interesting point in history where we are seeing. I mean, I saw a tweet before I came in here from Planned Parenthood that was there's an article today on the Hill in the opinion column about saying that federal dollars are not going toward abortions, and then this tweet said, you know, obviously they were applauding this article, and then they said, the discriminatory Hyde Amendment's been in place for 40 years. And so even in that, they are clearly showing that they desire federal dollars to cover abortions for everything. But also what they're showing is, well, they're not being completely truthful about the way budgets work and how, you know, that those federal dollars allow them to do a lot of things. But that's what I want to get into when we come back from the break is,
sure,
what is, first off, let's kind of put it out there. Why do we believe it's important to defund Planned Parenthood in terms of the federal funds that go there every single year in large amounts? And why do we talk about that so much? I think that'd be important for the listeners to hear. So we'll be back in a second with Kristen Hawkins. Hey, we're back. It's Andrew Wood with Hope Resource Center, joined today by the president of the Students for Life of America, Kristen Hawkins. Thank you so much for tuning in. So as we ended the last segment, we were talking about the amount of funds that are going from tax dollars from the federal government to the largest abortion provider in the country, Planned Parenthood. And so some people that are listening to this may say, well, why do y'all seem to talk about that so much? Why is that so important if the Hyde Amendment is in place and federal funds are not supposed to be covering abortions? Why bring that up? So let's kind of flush that out of why we keep bringing that up.
Yeah, I mean, this is an important question. This is something that actually I get asked a lot from our own pro-life students.
Right.
Why do we keep talking about Planned Parenthood? What's so important about Planned Parenthood? We all know that they're bad, that they're killing 900 children a day, but what makes them different? What makes them different is that they are the Goliath of the abortion industry. They commit over a third of all abortions in our country, 900 abortions every single day. At the same time, they are receiving more than $1 million of our taxpayer funds every single day. This is a nonprofit, a registered nonprofit, that rakes in a profit every year of between $70 to $150 million. A nonprofit. This is a nonprofit whose affiliated C4 and PACs put more than $30 million into the 2016 election. They are one of the biggest lobbyists in Washington, D.C. And as we know, as their taxpayer funding goes up, their actual services go down, except for abortion. So, for example, their latest annual report that just came out at the end of May, they saw 100,000 fewer clients in the previous year, despite receiving more taxpayer funds. Their cancer screenings dropped. Their prenatal services dropped. Everything dropped except for their abortions. It's directly correlated. The more federal money you get, the more abortions that they commit. 95% of pregnant women who walk into Planned Parenthood's doors are going to get an abortion. We have more than 13,000 federally qualified health centers, more than 3,000 pregnancy resource centers across the United States who are willing to serve women who will, many of these, the 13,000 federally qualified health centers provide every service that Planned Parenthood already provides, but for truly nonprofit, and they don't commit abortions. This is who we should be funding. We should be funding pregnancy centers. We should be funding these true nonprofit community health centers. We have no reason to fund Planned Parenthood because they're simply not needed.
Well, and here's the thing that really gets me. And you have some experience in the political world, as do I. That was my previous profession. And as we look at that, and the numbers that you just laid out, the numbers that I know, the numbers that you know, the articles that we read, the reports that we read, the statistics that we see, and yet we currently, even what we know right now is Congress, the House and the Senate, and currently the Oval Office are occupied by those that claim to be pro-life, right? The party that claims to be pro-life currently occupy those seats. Yet we are struggling, even with the latest healthcare bill that they're discussing, we're struggling to see true teeth put into, hey, this funding is going to go away. I mean, we've seen talks about it, but we also see some senators and we see some folks that are getting a little weak-kneed and, well, I don't know if we need to do this or not. From your discussions, and I know that Vice President Pence has met with pro-life leaders a number of times, from what you're hearing on the Hill in D.C., what does it look like in the next few weeks, months to come? I know that they're going to release something this week and they postponed recess, but what does that look like for us?
Well, you know, this is a really complicated situation, actually. I was working on something today, and I tried to keep it short, and it ended up being 2 pages just explaining to students. The House has passed a health care reconciliation bill that defunds Planned Parenthood. Mm-hmm. The challenge that we're seeing is we can't pass just a normal bill to defund Planned Parenthood because you need 60 votes in the Senate to invoke cloture, meaning the end of the debate of a bill to actually vote for the bill. And if you don't have 60 votes, the minority party can filibuster. And the Democratic Party, who has made it a huge part of their platform to support taxpayer-funded abortions whenever, wherever, says, you know, promise and will filibuster anything. So we can't do a normal vote. So the way we have to do is we have to figure out a way to defund Planned Parenthood without requiring 60 votes. And the current thought is to defund Planned Parenthood through the budget reconciliation process, through the Obamacare appeal and replacement, because that doesn't need to deal with the 60 votes. We can pass it with a simple majority. The House has passed their version of budget reconciliation to basically replaces Obamacare, fixes some of the major issues of Obamacare, defunds Planned Parenthood. The Senate's creating their version. There's some problems with the Senate version because while the way it's written, it's being floated to senators, it defunds Planned Parenthood, and also prevents taxpayer dollars from funding abortion coverage in Obamacare exchange insurance plans that are taxpayer subsidized. However, the Senate parliamentarian, an unelected official, can rule that that doesn't hold water and it has to be removed from the reconciliation bill, which would actually make the reconciliation bill potentially a bigger expansion of taxpayer-funded abortion than we've ever had in the history of our country. So we're kind of holding our breath on that to see if the Senate parliamentarian holds that up. But we're also seeing right now is infighting within the GOP. The GOP
right.
has a majority in the Senate. But, you know, for a long time, the Republican Party has peddled this big tent philosophy when it comes to abortion of, well, you can view abortion however you want. We just want to be a part of our party. And I guess they think it helps them win elections, but it doesn't help them keep the majority because what's happening is there's two GOP senators who are pro-abortion who have threatened not to vote for any bill that defunds Planned Parenthood and that doesn't force taxpayers to fund abortion. So now we're down to right at 50, and there's some senators who they want a full repeal of Obamacare, while other senators just want to fix Obamacare because they're afraid of the political damage of repealing Obamacare. So quite frankly, it's a mess. The GOP has the majority, but they have a slim majority, and their majority can't agree on the best way to fix Obamacare, which Andrew truly baffles me because they've had, you know, how many years?
Well, that,
since 2007 freaking years to write their Obamacare repeal and replacement plan. And apparently no one got busy after Election
Right,
Day.
And that was going to be my follow-up is we've been screaming this for 8 years. If you listen to talk radio anywhere, if you watch news anywhere and you saw a person with an R beside their name, they were saying this is the first thing on the list. This has got to go. We got to completely repeal it. And then we have the opportunity, and it's like, oh, it's actually here. We caught the car. What do we do? You know. And so it really is baffling as we watch. And for pro-lifers, for people like me and you that are working with organizations every single day, getting up, ultimately, regardless of what happens in D.C., we still have patients that are coming tomorrow. Regardless of what happens in D.C., we still are going to be there for that patient tomorrow and not charge them a dime, not charge their insurance a dime, not charge the taxpayer. So, and we're happy to do that. But as I have conversations with political leaders and conversations with community leaders, the focus at some point has to get to, look, yes, we want it to be unthinkable, but in order to get to the unthinkable happening, somewhere along the way, it's going to have to be illegal. Somewhere along the way, we're going to have to get to a point where we're saying we are no longer okay as the greatest country on the face of this planet. We are no longer okay with leading the charge for abortion with our funds and with our actions and with our speak. And it's just it really is an interesting thing. And then now what we're seeing is and this is what I want to talk about here in a little while is the Charlie Gard case that isn't happening in this country. But it certainly points to why the life issue in the womb is so important. Because if you don't get that right, then you'll get it right. You'll get it wrong with an 11-month-old. You'll get it wrong with a cancer patient. You'll get it wrong with someone that has reached an older age. And that's what we are seeing across the board is we devalue it at the beginning, and so we've devalued it all along the way.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I've been corresponding with my friend who's over there in London right now with Charlie's parents and trying to make headway. And it's so sad because, you know, this is what, you know, political liberals in our country want. They want a single-payer healthcare system. And they know the Obamacare exchanges are failing. There was a new report that came out yesterday. I mean, more than 2 million Americans are already going to lose their health care provider next year. A lot of counties and states across the country, there's only one insurance plan you can actually choose to be in the Obamacare exchange. It's awful. It's unsustainable. The companies, there's no financial incentive for them to participate in the Obamacare exchanges. We knew it was unsustainable. We knew it was going to fail, but part of me wonders, like, did they want it to fail? Because when it fails and we have all of these Americans who want to have health insurance, who want to pay health insurance and make sure their families are protected, how are we going to help them? And what's going to be offered by the Democratic Party, it's going to be a single-payer health care system, and we're going to have exactly what the UK has, the exact system that's kidnapped Charlie Gard and is telling his parents that they don't even have the right to take him home to the hospital or die, let alone pay out of pocket to transfer him to another hospital in another country.
Right,
I mean, this is what's happening. The state is kidnapping their child. The state is literally kidnapping their child, and that's what's going to happen here. And that's what happens when you have single-payer health care system. And while we need to make sure we're protecting families across the country who have medical emergencies, who have medical needs and can't afford their medical care, we have to make sure we never get to that situation.
Yes, and Kristen, let's continue with that when we come back. We're back. It's Andrew Wood with Hope Resource Center today, joined by Kristen Hawkins, Students for Life of America. And we're talking today about a number of different issues. But as we look at the Charlie Gard case that's happening, and if you're not familiar with that, it's a case where a young boy was born. He's 11 months old. He now has a terminal disease. The parents want to seek out experimental treatment with him in the States, here over in the U.S., the hospital and the courts are saying, well, the hospital took it to the courts, and now they're saying, no, he will, what they say, quote unquote, die with dignity inside the hospital, instead of allowing these parents to live with dignity and try to save their son, or at least attempt some more procedures. And I will say that this isn't a case where, at times we see cases where parents will elect not to provide any type of care for a child, and they claim that it's a conviction, and then a hospital may step in. This isn't even that. This is parents saying, we want to go out and seek more treatment. And now they have seven doctors around the globe saying this treatment could help. They have raised almost $2 million. They have over 300,000 signatures in a petition saying, let this family seek the care that they want for their child. And so as we talk about this, Kristen, as we look at kind of what is down the road and what, frankly, could happen right here in this country if we're not careful. As we look at that, why is this important for pro-lifers to care about? I think there's a lot of people that aren't really paying attention to what's going on, or that they're not putting a lot of effort in paying attention to what's going on in this particular case. But why should we as pro-lifers not just care about the abortion issue, but care about issues like this with Charlie Gard and doctor-assisted suicide and all of that?
We should care about this issue because, you know, Charlie is a human being with rights, and his parents have rights, and he's their son. And this is an issue where, you know, the culture of death is just running rampant, where your value as a human person is determined by the state, determined by what some people think you bring to the society. And here, the doctors in the hospital there in London are saying that there's a slim chance he would ever live or would ever be, you know, a functioning member of a society. Therefore, it's better to just let him die. And this death with dignity mantra that keeps coming up. But there's no dignity here. They've literally kidnapped their child. They're refusing to let him go home to die in his parents' arms. They're refusing to let him be transferred. I mean, this is a hospital who's saying, no, we know better than you. And I think that's very scary for pro-life advocates. It's very scary for anyone. I have two children with genetic disabilities, and it's very scary to think of a hospital being able to tell me what treatment my child can and cannot receive, and even be get to the point where to tell me I have no say in what happens to my child. This is saying that these children don't have dignity, these human beings don't have dignity, that the hospital knows best, and it's utilitarianism at its best.
Yeah, and as we look at, across the spectrum, and this is why having a consistent life ethic is so important. Because, you know, I've often said, if you're not pro-life, then don't be surprised when someone walks into a school or a club and shoots a bunch of people. Because all he's doing is saying, look, some people have more value than others. That's what we've been told since we were kids. That's what abortion tells us, is that some have more value. That's what doctor-assisted suicide tells us. Some have more value. That's what death panels tell us, is that some have more value. I mean, there's places around the world right now where 100% of those that are diagnosed with Down syndrome before they were born are aborted. I mean, that's where we are as a globe, and certainly this country, we are starting to see where, you know, my wife and I, for instance, we were asked by our doctors, do you want to perform, you know, the different tests? And I'm not making a statement on whether you should have certain tests at certain points of the pregnancy or not. But we said no, and then it was almost like we were shamed for not doing it. And then they'll say things like, well, They told my wife, well, your husband works at Hope, so I'm sure it won't change his mind on anything. As if that's a negative thing, that she has a supporting husband who wants to have a child with her. But that's where we are is, and for me, if we are consistent that life begins at conception, that life inside the womb has value, that life outside of the womb has value, then what we will tell our kids, what we will show the world is, look, it doesn't matter who comes in front of me, who walks in front of me. They are an image bearer, and they have value to me. And in this particular case with Charlie, it's just heartbreaking to think of these parents and what they're dealing with. And I read an article yesterday where it was saying that the dad was shouting at the hospital's attorneys, and I'm like, yeah. Well, I'm surprised that it didn't go further than that, because he all he wants to do is protect and do what he believes is best for his child.
That's exactly right. And this is just the effect of abortion on demand. I think that's what's so frustrating, is that to me, sometimes abortion advocates will think that, you know, abortion has been a positive for our society. It's been a negative for our society. It's been that downward spiral that we have in our nation. Because once abortion was legalized, then why not legalize assisted suicide in many people's minds? Because you've already devalued preborn children, why not devalue people who are here and may have Alzheimer's or suffering with a painful disease? And that's the slippery slope that we're talking about. And that's what's so, it's hard to be a pro-lifer sometimes, because we have to be consistent. And it makes you take sometimes a stance that other people can't see or have a hard time accepting. But this is what the reality of what we're talking about. And this is what's so concerning, is that the rhetoric we hear in Washington, D.C. over and over again about health care being a right, and how all Americans should have free health care given to them by the government, should be guaranteed. What they're talking about is single-payer health care, just like in the U.K. And that's not going to be good for any American. And I think that's what's very concerning to us as pro-lifers, because we know that's when the death panels come in. That's when they start to decide who receives that knee replacement or hip replacement and who doesn't. This is why, you know, Canadians come here for a lot of surgeries, because the wait lists there are so long, because they're not able to get the surgeries they need. That's why, you know, my son and my daughter receive a medicine that's hundreds of thousands of dollars a year that was developed here in the United States, and it's helping them, and it could, doctors believe, add a decade of life. But children with cystic fibrosis in other countries still aren't able to receive these drugs because of their government, who are single-payer healthcare systems, refuse to pay for the drugs.
Yeah, and again, the consistency, that's why it's so important. That's why I'm glad to see when elected officials post, you know, on Twitter and social media, and they're like, we're sitting down with pro-life leaders. That's why I'm glad. That's why I sat down with someone running for governor here in the state. That's why I sat down with our governor, because we at the pregnancy center world, we in the pro-life world want to have their ears to say, look, this is why this matters. This is why this is important. This is why we want to fight for every life. And we'll talk more when we come back. And we're back. It's Andrew Wood, Executive Director of Hope Resource Center. As we finish up, Kristen, and with our conversation on life, where can folks learn more about Students for Life? Maybe there's a college student listening today, and they want to start something on their campus. Where can they learn more? Who can they connect with?
Sure. We can just go to our website at studentsforlife.org. And right there on Students for Life, you can find out all the information you need to know about how to start a group. We can help you start a group. If you're a parent or grandparent, you want to get your young person involved, we can connect them with a local group. You can just email us at info@studentsforlife.org.
Yeah, and I think it's great what y'all are doing. Certainly we support your work. And if there's anything we can do here in Knoxville, around the state or around the country, you just let us know, because we are, we're fighting the same battle, and we just want life to be valued. And if I can one day lay my head down at night, for the last time, and know that we did all we could to fight for the value of life, then I think that's a life well lived. And and I appreciate being able to do it alongside people like you and other organizations and other pro-life leaders in this country who just simply we have a simple mantra of just saying that life has value and that that should matter to us and that's something that we'll never apologize for. So thank you so much for the work that you do. Again, let me know if there's anything we can do. I hope to see you at the march in January. Okay. Our baby is due right around the march, so I'm trying to decide. You know, as we get closer, we'll see what that looks like. But I do hope to be there.
Thank you for all that you do, Andrew, and Hope. You guys are incredible. I can't wait to come down and visit the center.
Absolutely,
one day.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Talk to you soon.
God bless.
So that was Kristen Hawkins, the president of the Students for Life of America, and the reason I wanted to bring her on today is because first off, I want you to know that that even you know we're right here in Knoxville, Tennessee, but we're reaching out all across this country with pro-life leaders and advocates. And it's important because we are in a college town and we have the University of Tennessee right here. We, you know, 30,000 plus students, if you include grad level students right here in Knoxville. And so the impact that we can have is a great one. And I've met with pro-lifers. I'm having coffee in the morning with a college student who is wanting to volunteer at Hope, and he's a male. That's even better. And so we're trying to reach the college campus. We're trying to reach this generation because, folks, let's be honest. This generation is the generation that's going to see the change made, or they're going to take us further down the road of destruction. And so what I would say to you right now, if you're sitting there, and I'll admit, I laugh, I'm a millennial, but I laugh at the videos that I see where they're poking fun at millennials and they're making fun of them and you know, pastors that come out against millennials and saying, you need to do this, you need to do that. I'm right there with you. I am all on board with that. But let's not neglect the truth that generation, the millennials, are the generation that's beginning to see that a generation has been aborted. So it is that millennial generation that is saying, we have to do something. It is that millennial generation that has seen ultrasounds their entire life. It is that millennial generation that has been able to watch a baby grow inside of a woman. And so the arguments of the past that said it's a blob of cells, that said it's clump or a blob of tissue and a clump of cells, those arguments are in the past because they're not true. And the millennial generation sees through that and they say that's not true. The millennial generation longs for people to be authentic and truthful. They're all searching for truth. And I know some of you are listening right now going, I don't think that's right, but trust me, they are. They want truth. And the truth is, that's a life inside of the womb. The truth is, the mom carrying that life has value too. The truth is, the dad that participated in that life has value too. The truth is that Charlie Gard at 11 months old and sick with a disease has value too. The terminally ill patient has value. The baby born with Down syndrome has value. The baby miscarried has value. And so what I want you to understand is as we walk through this and as we look at how we are pro-life, let's be consistent in what that is. And yeah, it's not going to be easy. There are going to be some people that are not happy with the way you stand on those issues. But you be civil and prepare to have the conversation. But that's what we have to do. We have to prepare. That's why we do this radio show. That's why we put it on podcast. That's why we blog. That's why we do everything that we do at Hope Resource Center. That's why we have people like Kristen on the show. And in a couple weeks, I'm going to have Stephanie Gray, who is she speaks all over the world. She recently spoke at Google about being pro-life. We have those folks in here for those conversations because we want you to be equipped to have those conversations with friends and with family and with neighbors, with coworkers. I don't want you to look like a deer in the headlights, not knowing what to say. I don't want you just being bitter and angry and coming off as a hateful person. I want you to have the facts. And I want you to be able to articulate your stance on life and why you are so boldly, unapologetically pro-life. Because it's making a difference. You heard the numbers by Kristen. It's making a difference. For the first time since Roe v. Wade, we have a generation that is trending toward more pro-life than pro-choice. We have a generation that is trending more toward anti-abortion than pro-abortion. That's a big deal. It's a huge deal. And so what are we doing to capture that? So if you have a college-aged kid, if you have a high school-aged kid, if you have a middle school-aged kid, what conversations are you having with them? If you are a college-aged kid or a high school-aged kid, or are you wanting to start a group within your school, let's talk about it. Email me, andrew@knoxvillehope.com. Never be ashamed to stand for life. Never be ashamed to say that every single life, every single person you come in contact with has value and they deserve your love. We're happy to do that. Thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you soon.
Lift your head, weary sinner. The river's just ahead. Down the path of forgiveness, salvation's waiting.